Well, now, coming on to this last talk then, on marriage counseling itself, I'd like just to add a couple of comments to what Graham has already said. First of all, I would reinforce the quote that he made of me when I said previously that anyone can give counsel, but not all are counselors. Now, I went into this in great detail up at the Advanced Leaders Seminar at Camp Kedron last weekend. In fact, we discussed it for about 4 hours last weekend, this particular subject. I think that we can, every one of us, I believe, in a celebrant situation, should be very much in prayer about the subject of counseling. I think counselors have a special gift. They are not the person generally who is unapproachable, unpleasant, over rigid, critical, but rather a person who has a special type of personality that the person coming to can feel at home with. They feel that they can confide in them. And I think, you know, that it's one of the greatest compliments in life to be approached by people for help, or approached by younger people to marry them. It's a tremendous privilege, because they are looking upon you and me as a new figure of authority, a new kind of parent figure, if you like, someone in whom they are going to put their trust and reliance. And the words which are given to them in a counseling situation are words which to them are worth their weight in gold. So we've got to be very, very careful in the counseling situation generally. I think that we've got to be careful from the counseling point of view in remembering that God has made us with two ears but only one tongue. In other words, a counselor is somebody who is prepared to listen. And you can't emphasize that enough. Now, of course, Rogers said that man was born with ears but no tongue. And Adams suggests that the tongue should be ready to move at any time. As I've suggested, I think that there are time to speak, but there certainly is a long time to listen. And the good counselor is somebody who is prepared to listen to whatever is said, initially without any comment, without any criticism. Just let the person talk. Let them have the expression of what they're trying to say. And I do think that the very first words which a counselor should give to anybody who comes to him are words which show, A, his availability, and secondly, his desire to help. And I also think that the comment about the comment I made about the tea is a relevant one. At the lunch table today, somebody was speaking about certain times of day when people are very tense and tired, and counseling can be difficult. This is true. And I think that there's nothing that can probably break down a lot of barriers of tension and fear and apprehension than the counselor and the counselees having a cup of tea before they start discussing anything serious. And I'm all for it. Leave the teapot there and serve it out yourself. I think it's a good thing. After all, you've got to be informal whilst at the same time having a certain degree of formality. Now, I think that also we've got to remember that when people come for any kind of counseling or help, that they do not usually present the problem for which they came immediately. they will very often tend to test out the counselor to see his reactions, to see if they're suitable for him to really communicate with. And sometimes, in fact, they will never bring out their problems openly. And this is where technique of the counselor is tremendously important. Encouraging, perhaps even giving a leading question deliberately in order to encourage the person to ventilate what they feel. I'm a Rogerian, and I believe that in confrontation at the right time. But I suppose that from the psychological point of view, I'm an eclectic, which simply means that I will use different approaches at different times during an interview and in different situations. For example, if I feel that things are coming to a bit of a slowdown in the situation, I will quite deliberately give a directive question. I will try and put myself in the person's shoes. The word that is used for this is not so much empathy, but what is known by a big phrase called the phenomenological approach. And you put yourself into the client's shoes. And how would I react in this situation? What's the possible problem that he or she has? And if there's a stop, I then give a question in which I deliberately lay a foundation for that particular subject to be brought out. And this is how, by the way, you get over the problem of Rogerianism and psychoanalysis. And please don't mix up psychoanalysis with psychiatry, by the way, they're quite different. Because if you go to a psychoanalyst with a problem, and he'll use this Rogers approach, however little your problem, he will tell you that he cannot deal with the problem in under 2 years of weekly appointments. And I believe the coming of the Lord is a bit too near for that, to take that approach. We're having the time to wait for 2 years. And this is the reason why I feel that I should use a much more positive and direct approach, tending towards Adams with his nuthetism, and say, right, this is what should be done. This is what the scripture says, this is what I'm suggesting to you. Now, first of all, very briefly, marriage counseling itself, there are problems within marriage. And I believe with all my heart that the counselor or the celebrant should always make sure that the couple he is marrying are aware that he will be available after marriage. After all, you are making a contact, making a relationship which is unusual in its values. You're getting a relationship which is unique. And the only thing that it comes near is the relationship of a child to a parent. And if that person has come to you in confidence, they are going to accept your word, and they are going to act in what you say. And it is inevitable that when problems arise within a marriage, little or great, it is very likely that the person that they will be most drawn to come to will be the person who actually proclaimed them to be man and wife. So that to be a celebrant has a tremendous responsibility from that point of view. I'm not going to speak very much about the counseling and marriage problem. We can perhaps leave that to another conference. It's a tremendous subject in itself. But I would point out one or two little points. There are certain symptoms in marriages which always lead to counseling being necessary. These are symptoms, by the way, not causes. The symptom, for example, the commonest symptom of a marriage problem is, strange to say, desertion. Now, desertion constituted about 60% of the decreed absolutes given under the recent act, the old act, affecting husbands more than wives. The symptom of adultery
was only 26%. And following that were drunkenness and cruelty, insanity, and sexual disharmony and incompatibility. Once upon a time, sex was looked upon as being the major cause of problems and the real reason why people came for counseling, but this is not so now. However, it is true that if you're going to look at the kind of things that lead husbands and wives to quarrel, then sexual difficulties must be rated number one. And this is one of the reasons, by the way, why you must know something about sexual attitudes and sex itself in everyday life. There's a natural diffidence, of course, in many of us to talk of sex. And this became evident, I may say, in some of the questionnaires when they came back. Sex was something which some of the non-answers gave an indication that this wasn't actually dealt with unless it came up from the people themselves. But of course they might be diffident as well, so that perhaps a whole area was being ignored here. And it certainly is the number one cause of quarreling between husbands and wives. The question of money is the second commonest cause of quarreling between husbands and wives. And the third one is one which is rather interesting. It's the working wife. Now, I've said a lot about working wives in public over the last few years, and I've been criticized particularly by some humanists of what I've said. I don't care because it's true. For example, I think that the women who work, particularly in the first 3 years of a child's life, are taking away from that child its only teacher. Now, I know that there are some situations which demand that the wife work at that stage, but if at all possible, I don't think that any woman should work for labor gain outside the home if she has a child of 3 years of age or under. It has been estimated by sociologists that women will do more than half of all they ever will do for that child during the first 3 years of his life. So if the mother's working during these first 3 years, the child will lose more than 50% of its education at the hands of its mother. Now, I think that's a startling fact, and that's a fact that is well established. The working wife can be a problem sometimes in as far as her earning capacity is concerned. At any age, the wife happens to be of a higher intelligence than the husband. The husband feels very threatened about this, and particularly if his wife can clear an extra $20 per week, more than he can. This is something that really rubs the wrong way. And this is a very common cause of problems that we see. The fourth cause of quarreling has got to do with the relationships between in-laws and families generally. Interference from other people, dominant mothers and dominant mothers-in-law. And the fifth thing is religion. Now, of course, we are in the happy situation, I believe, of being able to tell counselees what the scriptures teach. If we are not in that position, we ought to be. Because after all, this is the textbook, the only real textbook that we can recommend 100% to everybody. Now, having said that, I want to move on.
Excuse me, can I ask you, was there a percentage in that group?
No. I haven't got any percentages for these men, but they are in order.
In order of problems.
This is right.
You don't lose as reasons not to break them.
No, for quarreling. Sex difficulties, money, working wife, relations with families and in-laws, and fifthly, religion.
Now, having said that, I want now to move on to what I think is even more important from our point of view as celebrants, and that is pre-marriage counseling. Now, I think that this is very important, especially in view of what we just read from Hansard about this new act, or this new bill, with its proviso that the celebrant has got to hand to the person requesting marriage a statement showing that premarital counseling is available, etc., etc., etc. Now, it's a very special form of counseling. The questionnaire that was handed out was exceedingly interesting in its results. I didn't get them all back, but of the ones that I've got back, it was very interesting to notice that the average time for counseling over all of those who returned the questionnaire was 3 3/4 hours. That was the average time. The longest time that was given by one person was 10 hours. And one person went so far as to state that he gave no counseling at all. Out of the number of questionnaires that came back, there were 2 that had no answer given. Just questions. But there's no question about it that there were 3 who only gave 1 hour, 2 who gave 2 hours, the majority gave 4 hours, and as I say, 1 that gave 10. There was no increase on 10. Now, during the actual discussions that were given by these people, of the 6 things that were listed, 80% of the celebrants spoke about the Bible meaning of marriage. 1 in 5 did not discuss this. I was rather surprised at that. Secondly, 66% discussed personal adjustments within marriage. And about the same spoke of personal relationships. When it came to the subject of sex, only 2 out of 5 spoke of it. 2 out of 5. And only 2 out of 5 spoke of parenthood. And they were the same ones that spoke of sex. When it came to finance and housing, about 50% spoke of this. 50% didn't. When it came to the question of counseling help after marriage, the majority said yes, if necessary, or something like that. But there were some who gave a very emphatic no. Now, you'll notice that we did not say, do you give counseling? Or do you actually, have you given counseling? But do you offer counseling? And perhaps the people who said no hadn't read the question very carefully. But at the same time, it makes you think. The other thing was that the question was asked about whether it was considered that the celebrant's knowledge and understanding of human relationships, current changes in social patterns, etc., were sufficiently adequate to provide satisfactory counseling both before and after marriage. Well, yes, yes. Yes, yes, more than 50%, yes. Well, I'll be quite honest, I couldn't say yes. To be quite frank, it comes back to the situation, I think, of if we think we know everything, we can't do what we really set out to do. No, let's be frank about this. Included in that was the current changes in social patterns. Problems of today. Now, this is a very serious thing. I think we've got to be aware of these things.
Some had had experience in counseling parties and established marriages where breakup was imminent or separation or divorce had been spoken of. I was very, very surprised to find that quite a few had knowledge of the new Family Law Act. And I'm very glad that the majority considered that there should be some provision made to give training in marriage and pre-marriage counseling and would be willing to take part in classes and conferences arranged. That was good. But coming back to the premarital counseling, this was something that to me, maybe I have no right to say this, but it just seemed to me that there was some possibility that there was something lacking. And if that's the case, then with a new bill now before Parliament likely to be passed, what are we going to do? Something has to be done. Now, what do we speak about in premarital counselling? What's it got to be about? We have, of course, in New South Wales, various bodies of people who are trained to give counsel within in marriage problems. There's the Marriage Guidance Council of New South Wales, that was Coghlan's group, the Family Life Movement of Australia, with John Robson at its head, and the Church of England Marriage Counselling Service with Gordon Beattie, and of course the other end of the religious scale, I suppose, the Catholic Family Welfare Centre with a rather remarkable man by the name of Phipps, one of the finest counsellors I've ever met, I think. But the fact remains that all these things are completely out with assembly influence and participation. I believe that we need to do something about this pre-marriage counselling situation. It's necessary to help the people that are to be married to express and to explore and to clarify their attitudes and their expectations, because they are open to problems and crises. Even those who are so very happy together, that have been led together without any doubt by the Lord, there are little things come in. Not big things. But you know, little things have a habit both of being very hurtful at the time, and not only hurtful, they can grow. Even a mustard seed can be uncomfortable, I guess, if it starts to take root. And as I said before, that the celebrant, when he's approached by a young couple, has the last formalized occasion for helping the premarital partners to prepare for marriage and for setting up of a new home. It is without any doubt the most opportune time in the whole of life for people to take in counsel. Usually, they are anxious to learn, if not overtly curious, about what it's all about. And this is why I believe that it should be taken advantage of. Now, there are three groups of people who come for premarital counseling. Number one, there are those who come to seek information. They come to seek either information or assurance. The problem is that in coming to seek for information, they've got to come to a person who has information. Obviously. And this is where training comes into it. You know, it's not a good thing, really, just to bring in our own experiences. We could always say, well, you know, my marriage is like so and so and so and so, my experience has been so and so. I think that you can bring that in as a last point in counseling, but certainly not near the front. Now, I certainly think that we've got to bring in long before that what God expects, what is taught in scriptures. Now, these people who come for information and reassurance include those who feel that they've got no particular problem. And they simply come along to the celebrant because they've got to come to him to get married, And they look upon him as a counsel, to give some counsel, because you see, it's the darn thing to get some kind of advice. And this group is very accepting of any counsel, strange to say. But it's up to the counselor very often to detect problems which the couple have yet not realized. And this, of course, is why I'm going to, in a few minutes, give you some suggestions as how to go about this idea of counseling. Secondly, the second group, are people with moderate doubts regarding marriage and themselves. They've got some doubts, perhaps, as to their own fitness to be marriage partners or parents, but yet they are determined to go ahead with the marriage. Now, there are some like this. They really have some doubts, but at the same time, perhaps because of the pressure of the partner, they want to go ahead and get married. And the third group are those with severe doubts. Doubts to whether they should get married at all, or they really question their own adequacy to function within a marriage. Now, obviously, in that particular case, in the third group, this is where the counselor must be very, very directive. If he feels that this should not go ahead, then he should say so. No uncertain manner. If need be, call in somebody else. If you like, call in another of the elders. What do you think about this, brother so-and-so? And brother so-and-so gives his opinion. And I think that this, we ought to be very, very firm about this. Now, what are the objectives of counseling at this stage? Well, there are five. Five objectives. Number one, to help a couple relieve their fears and worries and anxieties about marriage, and to communicate these to each other. Now, this includes, of course, some very practical issues. It might even become so specific, in fact, that at one stage of counseling, they may ask your comments about the wedding night and how they should act towards each other. They may be very anxious about this. But there are other things too, longer lasting, how they are going to relate to each other throughout life and so on. Secondly, whereas in the first objective it was important that they communicate these problems to each other, in the second, they've got to learn to share these with the counselor. I'll tell you why just in a minute. You've got to help them to express their feelings and attitude with regard to marriage, to share them with the counselor. Now, why? Love is blind, and love is blinding. And as I said before, they're in ecstasia. They're quite irrational. Don't tell them that, of course. But they really are, you know. They're beside themselves. They love each other so much. And therefore, perhaps they're unrealistic, even in looking at each other. And when one gives an opinion of how they feel, or their attitudes to something or other in regard to marriage, they're unable to really look upon these things objectively. And so it's necessary to bring in somebody who is not involved, who is not in love with them, who is not in an ecstasia, who is very solid and sober and down to earth and realistic. And allow that person to look at the situation with them. And they will then be able to accept what he, the counselor, tells them about these feelings and attitudes, pointing out the weaknesses of them, and so on. Thirdly, the third objective is to give general and specific information, education, and guidance regarding the responsibilities and problems of marriage. And that sentence is almost unwittingly taken direct from Mr. Enderby's comments. Not Mr. Enderby, Mr. Attorney General. Alicott. Now, it's important in under this new bill that the celebrant actually gives the soon to be married couple guidance regarding these responsibilities and the problems involved in marriage. And then fourthly, the fourth objective is to encourage mutual exploration of separate individual needs, goals, and values. You see, because of the fact that the two people concerned come from different family groups, it is very unlikely that they will have the same attitudes towards the major things in life. They must have differences because they are different people. One may feel that their attitude is the correct attitude, and the other person, well, he's entitled to his opinion, but he's wrong. And this feeling comes through a great deal once a young person's confidence is gained. So that there's got to be a mutual exploration of these goals and values and so on, and they are discussed. So that there comes about a unification of thought and attitudes. So that they become one in the reactions to the outside world, in the way that they are going to look upon things and so on. And fifthly, the fifth objective is to provide opportunities to practice what is known as the problem-solving approach. By stimulating the couple to work together towards the solution of their problems. Family Life Movement and some of their pre-marriage group discussions take the title of Let's Do It Together. And as I said before, in this morning sometime, marriages are made to be worked through, made to be worked at. Even the most perfect and idyllic marriage still has got differences that have got to be solved. And this is done by the two partners, if they're Christians, in the presence of the Lord, for that matter. Maybe on their knees, certainly with the scriptures in front of them, coming to the problem and discussing it prayerfully and carefully until they have worked through it. They don't leave the problem unfinished. An unfinished problem is like leaving a bit of rope at the end of a rope on the floor where somebody can trip over it. It's got to be neatly coiled up. The whole thing's got to be resolved. And by the counselor being there, he is encouraging them to talk one to the other. You think that, Mary? What about you, Jim? Do you agree with that? Well, now you tell Mary what you think. You haven't told her, but tell her now. You see this kind of thing? And you're encouraging them to talk to each other and work through the problem. Now, again, as I said this morning, I think that the premarital counseling by the celebrant, and I think it should be by the celebrant, because after all, he's the one who's going to join them together, should actually take the form of individual discussions with each one, but preceded and culminated by joint sessions. Now, there are two maxims, two little statements that are very important. Number one, if you're trying to make a diagnosis of the problems, if you're in doubt, arrange more sessions than jump to a conclusion that might be wrong. Arrange to see them again. And if you're still in doubt, get somebody else to have a talk with them. And the second thing is, if you're really in doubt about the couple, do not be frightened to ask for postponement of the wedding until the problem is sorted out satisfactorily. Above all, the partners should be encouraged to be frank, and the counselor should be frank too. Now, there are certain areas which have to be looked at. There are six areas that the counselor must look at in any couple. Number one, he should certainly go into the subject of the history of the courtship. How it all started. How did they meet each other? How long were they courting? The date of their engagement. And is the engagement considered long enough by the partner? I'll have you a long enough time. The counselor should try and find out, for example, if there's any evidence of simple infatuation and not love. And I think furthermore that there should be some looking into the reasons why the couple is getting married at all. And why at this particular time. A question like that can be very, very illuminating. All sorts of things can come up for the reason why people are getting married at this particular time. So the history of courtship is very important. The second thing is a consideration of the backgrounds of each of the partners. Now, I must at this point, and perhaps I should have gone first, the religious backgrounds. Now, if they're both Christians, of course, well, it's pretty easy. But is it? We talk of mixed marriages. We talk of unequal yokes. Now, the unequal yoke, of course, is a Christian and a non-Christian. But mixed marriages are a problem, too. And in a mixed marriage, you are getting people united who basically have some differences in their backgrounds, perhaps racially, perhaps as regards economically, perhaps as regards their basic beliefs. It's all very well saying that, oh, they're both Christians, that's good. But if one, for example, comes from an assembly background and one comes from a congregational background, what then? Are there probable differences? And the answer is yes, of course there are. One person has been brought up with a certain line of thought over all these years. Now they're going to be united to somebody who has had a different kind of background. And I think that this has got to be looked at, quite frankly and openly. Not that you're going to be perhaps, say, you must do this or must do the next thing. But you've got to be prepared to put down the evidence, the scriptural evidence, as to what should be done. Present it at least. Because you see, for example, on the subject of baptism. The question of baptism can cause tremendous problems between a Christian who is baptized and a Christian who is not baptized. The question of a Sunday morning service. There's a great difference between a normal, so-called traditional, morning church service and a breaking of bread service. And although love may appear to cover the whole problem for a start, there may come a point in that couple's life when these things are very important indeed. And one has to give way to the other, and usually it's the girl who gives way to the fellow, because husbands, of course, are in charge. So these things have certainly got to be looked at, the comparative backgrounds. Of course, again I say that when in the case of a background in which there's a Christian background and a non-Christian background, and the actual couple, one's a Christian and one's not, then I think the question of marrying that couple has to be very carefully looked into. I think we've got to remember that it is a very definite statement of Scripture that the unequal yoke is against God's will. And I think that possibly there's a great deal of ground to say, well, that couple should not be married. But on the other hand, you've got to think of another point of view. And that is by taking this couple and gaining access to them in talking to them, you may be making a link that the Lord can use in later days. Because after all, this couple are going to get married whether you do it or not.
So this is another point of view, and it's something that every individual has got to make up their own mind about. I know where I would stand, but you might be different. Of course, there are other kind of differences in background. We've got to think, for example, of social level. The values of a background, the goals and the interests. And it is true to say that the closer that backgrounds correspond to each other, the more successful and harmonious the marriage will be. But there are so many exceptions that the counselor should not really discourage if they are of different, say, social backgrounds. But certainly he must point out the differences and the possible adjustments which will be required. Educational background is another problem. The person of high intelligence marrying a person of relatively low intelligence, sometimes the problem won't appear until later in life, and then suddenly becomes very apparent that they're unable to discuss at the same level. And do you know when the greatest problem is? It's not just in the first years of marriage. It's after the children have grown up. You know, it's amazing. Two people marry each other, they live for each other, and then they have children, they live for the children, and the children go away. And by the time the children go away, the woman realizes she's over 40, and that's the end of life for many women in their own opinions. It is, you know. You know, I can almost tell for some of my patients when they've had their 40th birthday. And I have one lady who came to me, and she produced a list. At the age of 38, by the way, a piece of paper, in fact, there were a few pages, all pinned together with all the numbers. Number nothing was her 40th birthday, 2 years away, and she stroked off every day, one by one, as she went through it, waiting for her 40th birthday. That was the end of life. She really believed that, in spite of the maxim that life begins at 40. But you see, when the children are away, husband, of course, he's married to his wife by that time, and the husband and wife are back at the same stage as they were when they stood in front of the altar. No children, just each other. Well, maybe they'll still, I don't know. They'll come eventually, I know. But their own children, they're away from them. And suddenly they're left alone. Maybe their children have gone to Australia or to Britain or somewhere else. But they're away, and they're alone again. And suddenly they find that these differences really produce tensions. Or again, you've got to look at work history in the people concerned, and that's very important, their work background. And from that, of course, we can get a fair estimation of whether or not the person is able to take responsibility within marriage. Social class, family cultures, well, as I've said before, the closer they are together, the better chance of success. And we must remember that many women deliberately marry up in socioeconomic scale, whilst men tend to marry downward, strange to say. Men aren't frightened to go down, but women have a need to go up. And that's why the woman will try to get, if she's one of the huntress type of women, will seek out a man who is socially and economically higher than she is. Whereas the man doesn't worry so much, and he's prepared to come down, as it were, on a social scale. Their ethnic background, and this is important in Australia, is of tremendous consequence. And it's especially important if the people who are being married, that their parents were not born in this country. In other words, second generations Australians. This is a very difficult group. They are the people who begin to recognize the differences between races. The third area, oh, the time's gone, the attitudes of both families to the marriage. And please try and remember that it's important, you know, when two people marry, that the families become acquainted with each other. Somebody once said that courtship is one thing, but engagement is only there to allow the families to get to know each other. And there's a lot of truth in this. And then the fourth area concerns realistic planning for the marriage. What plans have they made? For the wedding, for that matter. For the honeymoon. and more importantly, for housing and for the income and budgeting. In fact, I believe that they should all be asked very specifically, have they discussed the question of finance and the question of budgeting. Fifth area, personality factors, and in particular, sex roles. I think that the counselor should have a good idea of what kind of person they are. Is the man very masculine? Is the woman very feminine? Or do they tend to be a bit the opposite way? And if you think they're a bit the opposite way, try and find out a little bit about what they see as their particular role in the marriage. Sometimes you get an indication of how the person walks. Their actual walk from the door of the front door of your house to the sitting room. The way they dress. The way they groom themselves. Sometimes even the way they smell. All these things are important. And the sixth area are their attitudes to procreation. And that includes, of course, the understanding of sex and of contraception. The question of having children. Have they thought about this? How they're going to bring them up? When is the first one going to come? When should they have the first one? You come across an increasing number of young people today who will say, oh, we're not going to have our first until we've got enough money. Of course, the argument there is very simple. If they're going to wait till they have enough money, they'll have no children. You just can't do that. There are many questions that we could bring up, that you could ask these people. But there is just one more thing I want to finish with, and that is this. If I can find the paper, I've lost the last little bit. Just a minute. Doesn't matter. We'll go ahead with it. What's to be done then? What should be done at this stage? And I leave these suggestions with you at this stage. First of all, I think that there is a great need for conferences such as this one today. There are many people who are trained and who would be willing to come and speak on this different aspects of this subject. I believe that we've got to look very carefully at our approach to being celebrants, to the responsibilities which we have, which do not just consist of standing in front of an audience and mouthing certain words and handing a ring to each of the partners. It is much more than that. We are responsible to God, point one, and we will give an account of our service someday, and it will be tried. Every one of us will give an account of ourselves to God. But we are also responsible to the state, because celebrant is a legal situation. And therefore we have a certain responsibility towards society. We are under authority of the state. In Romans 14, we are certainly under authorities that we've got to pay attention to. The laws concerning divorce, concerning marriage, concerning counseling, etc., are things that we cannot close our eyes to. We have a responsibility to society. Secondly, I think that there must be a definite reappraisal of our own availability and willingness to counsel those who've come to us to be married. I believe it's terribly important that we are prepared to counsel in various areas, not just the six that I mentioned in that question, but perhaps others. And to do this, we've got to be prepared to learn perhaps a little more than we already know, however much it is, so that we can give adequate information and correct information to these young people. And thirdly, we have got to be, I'm sure, we've got to make quite clear to those who come to us that we are available after marriage. Most important. And the final thing, and perhaps this is the most pressing, I believe that we in our assemblies are falling down in not providing actual classes for young people regarding marriage itself. If I may just tell you a personal experience as I close, a few months ago, I was invited down to one of the assemblies in Melbourne to have a weekend of special seminars to young people. The meetings were, there were four in number, 2 hours each. The subjects were the Christian in the home, the Christian and friendship, the Christian and sex, and the Christian and marriage. No older person was allowed into the particular chapel we were in, with the exception of two brethren who were actually looking after the whole thing. Nobody over 25 years of age. The questions, well, I have never heard questions like it in all my life. And not only in public questions, but after everything was finished, they were queuing up to ask individual and personal questions. Now that taught me a lesson. This is what is necessary, I believe, in our young people today, because they're up against pressures that you and I have never been up against. And I would seriously put to your consideration the possibility of this kind of approach being taken by our brethren in this state and in other states, by people, not just me by the way, but there are other people who could do it, taking over ministry along these specialized lines.